From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations with scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Soundings now presents the final segment in a series of discussions about contemporary American religious thought and practice. In a nation of ideological and philosophical pluralism, what's the function of religion in the creation of social, ethical, and political consensus? How would such a consensus affect or limit fundamental American notions about personal liberty and freedom in the search for answers to social questions like prayer in the schools, abortion, and national nuclear policy? The panelists are Marjorie Heyer, James English, Martin Marty, Harmon Smith, and Mark Taylor. Marjorie Heyer is religion editor at the Washington Post. James English is a Jesuit priest at the Leesville Road Parish in Raleigh, North Carolina. Martin Marty is a professor of history at the University of Chicago Divinity School. Harmon Smith and Mark Taylor recently completed fellowships at the National Humanities Center. Harmon Smith teaches at the Duke University Divinity School, Mark Taylor in the Department of Religion at Williams College. Here is Marjorie Heyer.
The thing that troubles me is that issues, particularly things like the abortion issue, get so polarized and so politicized and so institutionalized that maybe it's appropriate to say in the state of North Carolina that political careers hang on taking a stand on or becoming identified with particular position. But this happens to such an extent that vast numbers of people are unable anymore to engage in rational discourse or even evaluate for themselves where the arguments are. It seems to me that maybe that the one of the tasks of religion in the public realm in the years ahead ought to be to help to cool down the argument and to disengage from this kind of polarization to the extent that religious elements are in it, and they are to a very great extent.
So it seems to me the great question is, for people with religious conviction, is it possible to have an absolute conviction of your own, which in a society as diverse as our own, outside of yourself you can create a compromise on? Can you have an absolute value and in a society be willing to compromise with others with other values, even though your own value remains absolute?
I have a little formula that says our problem is that the civil aren't committed and the committed aren't civil. That is, those who believe they have a hold on absolutes haven't learned to recognize that they should see that the degree to which those absolutes hold them ought to be the degree to which they assure the integrity of other people's beliefs. And the civil people aren't committed in that the civil people very often think the issues aren't important, and they're merely tolerant. Everything is equally true and equally moral. And so both camps have a lot of work to do. Now, certainly everyone who has a profound belief would love to see it exercised further. But I would have to say that the very founding of this republic brought together people who were profoundly different, but they made coalitions. It was the Enlightenment figures like Jefferson and the Baptists who were squeezed out by establishment religion that got together and helped produce the fabric of religious liberty for a lot of other people who later came to buy it and see it and find it to be advantageous. I think Marjorie's right. It is easy to institutionalize these factions, to exploit them, to make money off getting them to hate every other one. That is the problem. And here's where I think American religion, which is an extremely fragile gossamer invention for doing this, does have some precedent of saying, I can believe something very deeply and creatively coexist with some people who don't. When a new force comes on the scene, they don't see that right away. I would like to say that I believe that in some respects the new Christian right has begun to learn to live with this. And I'll give one quick illustration. By a lucky, happy accident for the Republic, not necessarily for all the peoples of the world, most American militant fundamentalists have what the rest of the American religion thinks is an extremely peculiar view of how the world will end. Namely, that the Jews will regather in Israel, or that Israel will remain till the end of time, that Russia will make some move, there will be a battle of Armageddon, and then Jesus will come and rule for 1,000 years. They take a few clues from the Bible and they make this their story. Now, if you're not of that camp, it sounds absolutely bizarre. If you're in the camp, that's your whole world. Now, because of that accident, it happens that this community is extremely friendly to Israel, and American Jews, therefore, looking for allies, got interested in them. Now, this camp is precisely the set of people the Jews always thought were the most anti-Semitic in America. They're the ones who thought Jews were Christ killers and all the rest. Now they have big conferences, born of their common interest in Israel's destiny, and they find they like each other on a lot of things. And right now, the evangelical Jewish dialogue is far more congenial than the liberal Protestant National Council Jewish dialogue, which is very tense. Now, I take that, again, I'm not saying it's good for all the peoples of the world. If I were in the PLO, I wouldn't like it, and if I were an Arab, I wouldn't like it. I'm saying for our republic, it's good that you have the fluidity that groups that thought they were at war found an issue that brought them together and they began to learn something about each other. And I think the post-Vatican II Catholic-Protestant illustration came along just at the moment when you needed people who didn't know each other previously, and the civil rights movement couldn't have brought them together had they not been allowed to pray together. When you have some common reason to be together, you get the beginning of a basis. And you might oppose each other on another ground. Perfectly fine. That's what the Republic is. If I had to have a plot for how to get people to break down their isolations and tribalisms, I'd get them to join as many things as possible. And I'd love to see somebody on both sides of the Panama Canal issue marry somebody who are on both sides of the gun control issue, and have children who are on both sides of the abortion issue, and all of them join the Kiwanis and the Boy Scouts and the Moose and 7-8 other things, so that you have a pluralism of commitments. The new force are sets of people who didn't belong to anything else in the Republic, and they take all their signals from one evangelist, and then they wake up some morning and find, hey, there are reasons why these other people don't agree with us, and they're not all bad reasons.
I'm not convinced, but I was listening with interest to hear how it can be that one can hold a plurality of antagonistic commitments. Maybe to fools and children all things are simple, and it's difficult for me to understand how one in one's own person can say with a measure of integrity and candor, look, I believe this thing devoutly, I honor it, I want to live by it, I'm committed to it as true, right, good, but I'm not really all that committed to it. And if you want to be committed to something else, it's okay by me. John Cuddy's book, No Offense, I thought described very nicely the bankruptcy of liberal Christianity, American civil religion. The whole bit is calculated not to give anybody else offense on account of the passion or depth or whatever of you know, the set of commitments that you have and hold. I think there is a not unreasonable way of understanding beliefs, commitments, the kinds of obligations and so on that co-inhere with that as being profoundly intolerant. At a certain point, it becomes difficult for me to imagine whether it's possible on the terms you describe, if you're going to be so infinitely tolerant of everything, how it... Now we're back, it seems to me, to an earlier comment about religion. If religion is everything, then religion is nothing. If you can tolerate anything, everything, and maybe on Locke's principle, everybody is master of their own person and body, entitled to non-intervention, so on and so on.
I'd do it a little different way, Harmon. I would say we are all committees of selves. Yeah. And these different selves are bidding for certain kinds of attention. One of Marty's selves might assert that eternal salvation is only in Jesus Christ. Let's make that as a kind of a proposition. Doesn't have to conflict at all with the notion that I might be better off ruled in the civil order by an agnostic than I might be by a born-again Christian for a whole host of reasons, and the two don't really conflict because different aspects of the self are involved. In neither case am I therefore being tolerant. I may be judicious, but I'm not tolerant. I like Gabriel Marcel's word, counter-intolerance. I think you have to believe in things deeply enough to be tempted to be intolerant in order to assure a tolerance to others. And it seems to me that the great people of the 20th century are those who are deeply rooted in a tradition and then could internalize another one. You know, Martin Luther King needed Gandhi on top of his Jesus. Gandhi needed Jesus on top of his Hinduism. Pope John could deal with Jews and Khrushchev's son. Out of the tremendous security of their own commitment, they could find another aspect of that committee of themselves who could embrace someone else civilly. So I don't think it's a Cudahy's alternatives. What is the alternative to Cudahy's no offense except to go back to the Crusades when if I believe deeply I got to slit your throat? That's the implication that that one would get from reading no offense unless you find a third alternative.
I think this issue or cluster of issues here illustrates a point that we've talked about earlier in our discussion of tradition. Harmon Smith has indicated that he doesn't see how one can with integrity affirm multiple and sometimes conflicting beliefs. And I would say that one can't, but the issue is the problem of integrity. I said earlier that the one way to read Western philosophical and I think theological history is in terms of the problem of unity and multiplicity, or the one and the many, which goes back to Plato. And that's the problem we're talking about. One of the most profound shifts, I think, in the modern world is a reversal in the way in which those two are evaluated, as I said earlier. I quite agree. The self is not integral. It's a community of agents, a complex and conflicting community. And the quest for integrity is not only psychologically, but often politically repressive. I think it's a mistake to envision the dilemma in terms of a commonly shared rationality which can articulate a generally agreed upon goal in Lebanon. That's a false either or, it seems to me, because of precisely the constant interplay of plurality that doesn't necessarily, it seems to me, need to lead to the kind of conflict and repression that it sometimes does. But I quite agree on the importance of a more complexly variegated model, not only of subjects, but of societies as well, that allows for creative disagreement, will inevitably entail conflict, but does not either presuppose or prescribe any uniformity.
The luxury of tolerance is in a lot of ways a function of not having to come to grips with the social and political, not to say personal, implications of the toleration. When the Nazi scientists and physicians were tried in Nuremberg, their defense was, we were good citizens of the Third Reich. We did not break any laws. By all that is holy and right and good, as defined by National Socialism and the National Socialist State, we are not guilty of having committed any crime. Okay? The judges accepted that defense as being a valid defense. And then they said, but we find you guilty. And a number of them were executed, not because they had violated their own, let us say, privatized sense of what was right and wrong, but because, in the opinion of their judges, they had violated a law against humanity or something like that. Now, maybe what we're in the process of doing is testing the limits of our capacity to tolerate in terms of an ever-extending capacity for expansion and growth and that sort of thing. We have begun already to appreciate limits to growth in a number of other dimensions of our common life. We can't continue to exploit nature, natural resource, water supplies, air, and that sort of thing. And maybe the analogy is not apt. And I, you know, Marty, I don't have the answer to the question I'm posing. I don't want to be king, and I don't want to be pope. I don't know the answer to these questions. But my anxiety, my little worry, is whether we may also be reaching the boundaries of moral tolerance in the kinds of things that are being allowed or permitted out of an appeal to freedom, self-determination, that sort of thing, which is going to change as dramatically and radically the character of this organism we call a human being, as strip mining and some other things have done to the face of the earth.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to the final segment in a series of discussions about contemporary American religious thought and practice. The panelists are Mark Taylor, Harmon Smith, Marjorie Heyer, James English, and Martin Marty. Mark Taylor and Harmon Smith recently completed fellowships at the National Humanities Center. Mark Taylor teaches courses in the history and philosophy of religion at Williams College. Harmon Smith is a professor in the Divinity School at Duke University, where he specializes in medical ethics. Marjorie Heyer is the religion editor at the Washington Post. James English is a Jesuit priest in Raleigh, North Carolina. Martin Marty is a professor at the University of Chicago and is co-editor of the journal Christian Century. Here's Mark Taylor.
I have a suspicion that one of the differences that one of the sources of the difference between the way in which you approach this set of issues and I do may be related to the two wars that were the different wars that were formative in our experiences. In that war, there was a sense of commonly perceived evil that individuals were called upon to resist. My war, the war of my generation, was Vietnam, in which there was a reversal of that and the part of the perception of many. My point is that at the point when those decisions were being, at the point at which individuals, I think, faced that decision in the situation of the late 60s, rather than being called upon to participate in communal resistance to commonly perceived evil, we perceived ourselves to be called upon to participate in what was regarded as evil, and that radically transformed the way in which the whole issue of values in relationship to corporate participation has been perceived by a generation, I think.
Some people knew that about the Second World War. Reinhold Niebuhr knew that. Harry Emerson Fosdick knew that. That is, as you yourself said, there wasn't the unanimity of national consciousness about an absurdity for which there seemed to be no alternative but to go to war. I'm just asking whether in some very important respects we may not be approaching that point again. Some people... we've talked about abortion, are thinking that about abortion. Some people are thinking that about capital punishment. Mm-hmm. And I suppose, in spite of what Marty says about the folks being able to sleep relatively peacefully on the school prayer issue, there are some people who really get agitated about that. Certainly the nuclear freeze business is a case for agonizing over what kinds of people we're in the process of becoming. Okay, we are changing, and we're not the same people we were 50 years ago, or 30 years ago, or 10 years ago, nor the kinds of people we'll be 20 years from now. But part of what it would seem to me a humanist, to say nothing of a a religious humanist would be very much concerned about is what kind of people we are going to become. What vision is dominating our planning, our expectations, our hopes, our fears, our aspirations? That's really the only agenda I'm pushing right now.
But isn't that a question that religious people have always faced? I mean, isn't that the question that religious people faced over the question of slavery? Certainly there were people who did not sleep well at nights because they knew other people were being held as slaves. The question of capital punishment. I mean, if you go back in history, it seems to me that this has always been a question of at what point do you get to the point where you are becoming a threat to human values.
It's, to be sure, people on both sides of the slavery issue claim to be Christian. And some still do. And there were, of course, pro-slavery moral arguments, predicated largely on Aristotle, but not hesitating to use scripture in support of the argument. At a certain point, it became intolerable. And not just for moral reasons. There were also economic reasons, and there were political reasons, and there were social reasons, and there were international reasons, and so on. And all those things go into the mix. And I'm not for a minute naive enough to suppose that those things aren't currently in the mix on the kinds of questions we're talking about as well. I began by asking whether, at some point, and God knows I don't know where that point is, but in our conversations about tolerance and so on, is there probably a point beyond which tolerance cannot reach if we are to be a certain kind of people?
I wonder if I could ask a question which has been on my mind since something was said earlier, which is that at some point in our history, freedom as a means became freedom as an end. And freedom as an end of our society seems to be the one thing that we have totally in common. Is freedom as an end of a society enough to create the possibility of the enduring possibility of that society?
Let me try to unite the two concerns here, whether there really is an issue between us, and I think in some ways there is, and how the freedom one plays in. On one level, Harmon, I agree with you throughout that if the Republic degenerates into nothing but people who are claiming their rights for themselves as an entitlement, no matter what it does to the Republic, versus another set of citizens who in effect say, I'm so tolerant, I don't care at all. You can abort or not abort, you can do anything you want, I don't really care. Then I think, Jim, the freedom issue takes one shape. If you see the Republic formed a different way, as people from Aristotle almost to the present did, it is neither an unum, one great big totalitarian thing, nor a set of atoms, but a collection of people in sub-communities. Liberal Catholic, conservative Catholic, pacifists, Jews, Republicans, Democrats, labor, all these constituencies. It too is a committee of selves. And then you ask, how do these groups do any bartering among each other? And I think the issue that Mark Taylor and I were smelling as a basis for difference is when you invoke Alasdair MacIntyre or speak in general, there is either a sense of nostalgia for a day when it was easier because there was less pluralism, or a sense of groping for how can we get something because of the great pluralism we have. And I think that there is a difference here in that I would say on one hand, societies that have great measure of fundamental consensus, as American society did in 1800, 1865, when anybody who counted was Protestant, anybody who voted, anybody who ran the show was Protestant, they both believed in the same Bible, same God, same Jesus, same justice, same morality, and never settled slavery except with guns, may have been worse off than our society, where 200 competitive constituencies have to make room for each other and coexist with some things that keep some of us awake at night, but don't necessarily come to that sharp ahead that soon, while we're in the midst of constantly making fluid new commitments to other sets of people who believe some of the things we do. And I would argue that a lot of people do that very intensely. I've talked about the issue of your field, medical ethics. The Jehovah's Witness family has full integrity of belief and great zeal and fanaticism about it. And everybody else in society says, on some ground or other, belief in God, natural law, natural rights, what's fitting, what one shouldn't ought to do, or whatever. We're not going to let that baby die without a transfusion, and we intervene. That committee of cells gets its head together for a moment. And maybe we do that better than if we agreed with each other as much as Jehovah's Witnesses falling into two factions.
Well, I think it's a patent denial of the predicate on which the society otherwise exists for it to intervene in the private self-determination of these people. And
So you're opposed to the intervention.
The otherwise sacred aura that surrounds the family. You have introduced, to be sure, a concept of the common good or the public good, which is a relatively novel thing in medical care. Heretofore, one worried only about physician-patient relationships and fairly nuclear kinds of concerns. Now this issue has reared its ugly head within our lifetime, I think, and following the Second World War, principally. So we have said, right, we're going to inoculate preschool children, whether they want to be or not. We're going to quarantine people. We are going to protect the interests of people who are legally minors. And it's on that ground that the benefit of doubt is given to the Jehovah's Witness child, so that a transfusion is ordered when it seems medically indicated. I'm familiar with a case in which precisely that was done. The child was returned to its parents after a fairly routine surgical procedure. And 2 weeks later, the hospital got a call from the sheriff in the county where this family lived, wanting to know if they'd done that procedure and had provided a transfusion for that baby. And when the answer was yes, and the question then was, why do you want to know? The sheriff says, we have a badly battered baby on our hands here. These parents now regard the kid as defiled or impure or something like that, and they've beaten it unmercifully and abused it and so on and so on. What I think is part of what it means to be a compassionate and caring and humane society is to take account of the ways in which, out of respect for self-determination and so on, one violates that regard in the common good, but does not take appropriate steps to guarantee that the sequelae of that action also is a social concern or a public interest. And so you do something that ostensibly is nice and good, and it has a terrible, terrible result.
You've been listening to Soundings from the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond with the concluding segment in a series of conversations about contemporary American religious thought and practice. The panelists were Martin Marty of the University of Chicago, Father James English of Raleigh, North Carolina, Marjorie Heyer of the Washington Post, Mark Taylor of Williams College, and Harmon Smith of Duke University. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities.